Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Confident Hypnotherapist podcast. This week, my guest is someone who I am deeply humbled to have on this show. In fact, when I was sitting down before trying to figure out how to introduce this gentleman, I got a bit stuck. I could say that he's the founder of the British Hypnosis Research and Training Institute, and that he's someone who has pioneered the use of Ericksonian hypnotherapy based on Buddhist principles with compassionate Ericksonian hypnotherapy. But I think that doesn't sum up enough. So let me just give you an idea here. This gentleman first introduced Ericksonian hypnotherapy to Europe in 1979, established Ericksonian hypnosis courses in 1988 in London. Between 1990 and 1997, established Ericksonian hypnosis courses in 22 hospitals and universities across Europe and the UK. In 2003, launched the world's first online one-year training with over 6,000 enrollments. And even in recent years, running training in Buddhist psychotherapy, compassionate hypnotherapy, mindfulness and self-hypnosis in both London and Thailand, and doesn't seem to be slowing down or stopping anytime soon, with more courses coming up in the very near future. Mr. Stephen Brooks, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you very much for that very impressive
I almost feel like I need to go and have a lie down after that. A lie down or a drink.
I was thinking, who is this guy he's talking about?
It is an incredible list of achievements that you have done over the course of your career. Looking over it, I do really feel like I'm talking to someone who has dedicated their life to hypnosis. How did you get... What was it that attracted you to hypnosis and hypnotherapy in the first place?
Well, when I was a school kid, let's say about 14 or 15, I was living in Cambridge in the UK, where there's a very famous university. And if you walk around the unit, well, back then, if you walked around the university, they would have these flyers up on the wall of the Porter's Lodge, which is the gateway you walk through when you go in. And I used to see these lectures, and I used to just nip in and watch lectures. I shouldn't have been there. I was a kid. You know, I looked actually probably about 10 at the time. I was about 14, something like that. And I saw one on hypnosis. And I thought, that would be interesting. So I went in to see that. And I remember I can still visualize it. It must have had a very big impact on me. Mm. I was sitting at the top of a tiered auditorium, and the professor was using subjects he'd obviously hypnotized before. He wanted to play it fairly safe. And what he was demonstrating was hypnotic phenomena. And the two things I remember was that he'd got a girl out of the front to come up on the platform, and he hypnotized her, and he told her that she wouldn't be able to pick up a book that was on the table. It was very heavy. And I thought that was quite impressive. But then he got a guy out of the front row to come up, and he hypnotized him. And he told him that when he looked back at the empty in hypnosis, when he looked back at the empty chair, he'd see himself sitting there. So he was having a positive hallucination. Mm. And you can imagine, as a 14-year-old kid, you think, I want some of this. I want to do this stuff. And so that's how it started, really. I bought lots of books on hypnosis, but back then, they were mainly from the 50s and the 60s, and they were very direct, authoritarian hypnosis, nothing subtle about it. And they weren't really about therapy. You know, they're the kind of books you'd get into in a basic bookshop. They didn't have many books on hypnotherapy as such. So I bought those books, and I was just really disappointed. I thought, this is terrible. This is embarrassing almost. I knew there must have been something else better than this. But it didn't come along until a few years later, when I picked up the book that Erickson wrote with two other authors. I can't remember the names now. And I got that in the library. And it was a very old book from the 1961, I think, something like that. But Erickson's words just jumped off the page.
Is that what attracted you more so to an Ericksonian approach?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a strange feeling. I can still remember the feeling. It was like a feeling of awe. It's like, I don't know what he's doing, but what he's saying makes absolute sense to me. And it's of such a higher level than anything I've read. And so this is amazing. So that's how I started thinking seriously about, you know, actually becoming a therapist. If I hadn't found that book, I probably wouldn't have taken that direction. because I'd left it behind a few years before.
That's an interesting kind of sliding doors proposition there. If you hadn't found that book, do you feel that you may still be working within the hypnosis and hypnotherapy world? Or
I doubt it. I was curious about hypnotherapy, about hypnosis, should I say, but as a lot of kids are, I was interested in magic, you know, and mysticism and the occults and religion. And I was Buddhist when I was 16. My school teacher was Buddhist. He introduced me to Buddhism and I became Buddhist from 16 on. I used to go to the Buddhist Society in London every week to learn you know, meditation and stuff like that. And so I would have stayed interested in those subjects, but hypnosis was just one of the many other subjects similar to that. Mm. I actually went into the music business, in fact, you know. So I was actually in the music business until I was about 30-something.
What did you do in the music world?
Well, I started off as a songwriter and musician, got signed up and released records and stuff. And then I became an engineer and then a producer, a record producer.
That's incredible in itself. That's quite fascinating. And
well, the reason that ended was very simple. I went freelance. I was working for companies. In England, there's a company called ATV, and I used to work at a place called Pi Recording Studios. And it was very famous in the 60s for producing all of the big kind of British hit songs, you know, the Pi Studios. So I got a job there in the early 70s and or mid 70s, should I say. And so I was always employed. So I always had good money. Then I decided to go freelance. And so I did a lot of freelance work, but I quit my job in order to do that. And I started to suffer. I couldn't get enough work freelance. So I when I started working as a hypnotherapist in the late 70s, punk came along. So I was doing hypnotherapy in the daytime and producing punk bands in the evening.
What a juxtaposition that is.
Yes. And so the money wasn't there for me. I think the music business is quite a cutthroat business. You really have to push yourself hard, you know, number one.
Funny enough, my background was music industry as well.
Oh, so. Really?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know what it's like. And I just wasn't that kind of person. So I was also very shy at the time. I hadn't taught before, you know, up to that point. So but when you were, I was often presented with opportunities which I should have grabbed, but I didn't. I backed away or just sort of sneaked away out of the door because I didn't feel confident enough to kind of work with certain people or whatever, you know. So hypnotherapy was great. You're your own boss. You just work in a room with somebody, and that's how I started.
When you first started as a hypnotherapist, were you the type that was, you know, generally you see people who seem to just strive forward and are happy to work with almost anybody, and then you have those people that sometimes are kind of like, oh, no, I can't do that and I can't do that. They kind of hold them back from certain areas. How were you when you first started?
You have to jump in feet first. Mm. You really have to face the fear. And I understand, you know, when people are starting, you know, can I hypnotize somebody? What happens if I can't bring them out? All of this crap, you know, which actually is not a serious problem. But people are nervous about it. And I was very lucky, I think, in that the very first person I hypnotized was in front of a group of people. I'd never hypnotized anybody before. It was naive of me. I was asked to do a talk, and I was getting papers from Milton Erickson, only a handful, but one of them came through, and it was like, it was about him producing a negative hallucination, in fact. And I read it, and being naive, I just thought, oh, well, I've seen that in the university. Here's Erickson telling me how to do it. Okay, so now I know how to do it. So I put on the shelf. I gave the talk. It was grouped to a group of women. I think they were kind of Rotarian wives or something. I don't know what it was. And probably about 30 people. And at the end of the talk, they said, well, demonstration? I thought, oh, my God, I've never hypnotized anybody before. What do I do? I thought, okay, thank you, Milton Erickson. I thought, I'll just do what he did. And so in that paper, so I just did that. And luckily for me, it was unbelievable. I was so shocked at what we achieved. You know, getting a negative hallucination from somebody there was quite amazing. And I thought, my God, this is real. This is really something. So that was my first experience. Then when I started working, seeing clients, again, I was lucky because I was living in a place called Chelmsford in Essex in England, and it's very central to the county. So within 30 minutes, you could drive to many different towns. So when I set up, I thought, I don't want to risk, you know, renting an office or something like that. I'll use anything I can. I used like a friend's meeting house in one place. I used a council building in another place, hotel building in another. So I'd have just hire a room for a day in different places. In each of those towns, like five different towns. And I advertised in the main paper that went out to all of that county on the TV page. So over the weekend, people would always see that ad. It was a display ad, a very small display ad. I think it was a profile of a woman sitting sideways. And it said, I think it's like the classic, stop smoking, lose weight, gain confidence. It was something like that. Okay. And I just got so many people contacting my wife, who was taking all the bookings, that I was immediately full within like a week. And I was seeing patients all day, clients all day, every day for 5 days. And that continued for something like 10 years. So it was like, you had no choice. You couldn't be afraid. You couldn't. And I think that's such a great idea. And, you know, on the students I teach now, they want to copy that. And so what they do, they actually get together and they book therapy sessions with each other, but like that, hardcore, one after the other. So they take it in turns to see something like 6 patients a day, but they're all students. And then you're under the pressure. You just have to do it, sink or swim. And I think that it's experience. The only way you can really become good at what you do is by doing it, not reading about it. You can study it. You have to do all that stuff. But when it comes to doing it, you have to get your hands dirty, basically, like taking a engine apart.
Remember, a trainer saying to me once, you can, you know, get a book on how to swim, but until you get into the water, it's not really going to matter. And, you know, that definitely resonates with me. And I know many people who say the only way that you can really ever become a truly great hypnotist and hypnotherapist is to just practice. And keep getting at it. When you have students that have those doubts, so they kind of have that inner voice, that inner saboteur, that self-talk that says, you know, maybe I can't do this, or what if I can't hypnotize them, or what if I can't bring them out? What advice do you tend to give them?
I think, well, obviously no two people are the same, but generally, if somebody has a lack of confidence, which is basically what it is, first of all, I tell them, okay, if they're studying with me, you're learning the Ericksonian approach. Okay. And they said, yeah, but it's so hard. It's so different. It's more advanced. And I said, it's the coward's way to do hypnotherapy, because nobody knows what you're doing, because it's all indirect. So when you start your induction, the client doesn't know you're inducing hypnosis at that point, unless you say, now we're going to do the hypnosis stuff. Okay. So you can do you can mumble away happily using indirect suggestion or whatever you want. And the client doesn't know the hypnosis has started. So if they don't go into trance, they don't know you were doing it. So number one, you know, there's no need to feel scared. You can feel absolutely 100% confident to practice if you're using those kind of techniques. Number one. Number two, if you've got a general fear of, you know, talking with somebody, like a communication problem or something, then you need some therapy. So get some therapy while you're studying. Other students will help you with that. Go that direction. Lastly, make some self-hypnosis recordings for yourself.
Great idea.
Yeah. And basically, you know, just what you need is just get your little digital recorder or whatever, your iPhone, record some sessions as if you were talking to someone else. Not I am, but you are, because that's what you've been learned to do anyway. And then do not label them up, but have themes. So if example, if your problem is like overall confidence, break it down into chunks. Where, for example, is it lack of confidence in talking in public? Because you need to do that if you're going to promote yourself. Is it lack of confidence with individual clients? Lack of confidence in asking for money or selling yourself? And make each recording based on one of those small steps, not the whole thing. It shouldn't be like a please, make me wonderful. It should be broken down into something practical. And then don't choose a subject. Just lie down. Just click one of the MP3s. You don't know what's coming. That's the idea. You don't know what's coming. And then just go with it. And you'll probably come out with complete amnesia. And then just do that. And then you'll just notice things start to change. So they're the three things I recommend.
Three excellent suggestions there. Now, I know you work with compassionate Ericksonian hypnotherapy. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the implication, of course, is that often psychotherapy or hypnotherapy is not compassionate, which is certainly true in a lot of cases. Compassionate really means that the client is the most important person in your life at that moment when you're working with them. It's not a business relationship, even though you'd be charging money maybe if you're working privately, but that you perceive the client as being more important than you and the most important person. That is, you are committing 100% of yourself to that person. And if you are committing 100% of yourself to that person, it means you're not thinking about yourself. Is this right? Am I doing it right? Me. I don't want to fail. Because all of your focus is on that client. That way, the client will pick that up. They'll pick up that you really are communicating from the heart and you genuinely want to make a difference for them and you are there for them. That in itself, without any hypnosis, is healing because the client feels supported and understood, and that is therapeutic. So it's taking the concept of communication and using compassion as a way of kind of communicating and healing at the same time. And then when you use the hypnosis as well, of course, they're more likely to accept what you do because they trust you. And so it's like layers, really. You build up compassion through layers. And if you think of compassion as being the concept of unconditional love is where you don't want anything in return. You're giving love, but not because you want something back. You're doing it purely for that person. Of course, you always get something back. And that's the knowledge that you succeeded in helping someone. But you're not doing it for that reason. You're doing it because you want that person to be better, not because you want to feel good about them being better. So it's a slightly different angle, a twist on the way that we work. And it also ties into my Buddhist background as well. Though, I'm not including that in it. It's the same with any communication. You can be kind or you can be horrible, It's about respecting the client and realizing how honored we are to be in the presence of someone who's trusting us with their lives. That's an amazing context. Not many people are lucky enough to have that kind of job, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I love that whole notion of bringing Buddhism into hypnotherapy. How did you come across, not so much how did you come across, but what was your introduction to Buddhism? How did you find your way with that?
Well, let's talk about its relevancy in hypnotherapy, okay? Because how I came across it is a long story, of course. But I told you my school teacher introduced me to Buddhism. I studied Buddhism over the years. I eventually came here. I got ordained as a monk. I meditated for something like 4 years here. And so it's in you. It becomes who you are. If you commit to something, anything becomes who you are. So when I came here, it's because I wanted to escape that kind of rat race in England. And so the organization was incredibly successful. We were really, really successful. But it was too much. I didn't want to handle that. So everything went and I came to Thailand to meditate. But the reason I came to meditate was to come back to my roots in terms of Ericksonian hypnotherapy. Was there some way of integrating Ericksonian hypnosis with Buddhist principles, not with Buddhism as a religion, but Buddhist principles? And the principles are compassion, number one. The main principles, compassion, non-attachment, not becoming a victim, a victim of your thoughts, being able to not be affected by the stuff going around you, and dependent origination, which is a Buddhist principle, which is basically cause and effect, how every cause has an effect and how every effect becomes a cause for something else. And so take those three principles. And if I could find some new way of working, and that's why I came here, and that's what I did. So now I teach Ericksonian hypnotherapy, but I'm teaching a lot of the stuff that Erickson was doing. But I also put my own slant on it when I teach. And when I work therapeutically with clients, most of it is Buddhist principles in the Ericksonian context. That's my personal way of working.
If people were to come and to train with you, Can you tell us a little bit about that experience? What is it that they would come to expect?
Well, I now teach exclusively online because of COVID. And in fact, you know, I enjoy it very much, and it's become more popular, in fact, than people flying into London. And I used to, my last courses were at the Birkbeck College in London. And when COVID happened, you know, I was already, I started up an online course 10 years ago, as you said, yeah, which is very successful, but we didn't have a Zoom component. But now we've added Zoom to that, and we've got added exercises, and the students get together and practice together, added a lot more video content. And so it's Ericksonian, definitely Ericksonian, with that compassionate kind of approach. It's a one-year training. It's a commitment, you know, really quite a commitment, although people can extend beyond it if they can't keep up with it. So there's the online training, which is lectures, videos of lectures, demonstrations, forums for each lesson, an exam for each lesson. And then we have the Zoom sessions, which are three times a month, every Sunday evening, for 3 hours every Sunday evening. So it's a lot. It's a lot, but but you have to.
By the sounds of it.
You have to. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's again, it's about that commitment to class.
You know, you want. You only come onto any one training at any given time.
The Zoom sessions are normally 25 people at any one time. But it's a kind of rolling format. So, you know, every time a new intake comes in, somebody joins and somebody leaves. The way it's structured is that every single weekend, every single month is like a separate course. And no particular month is contingent upon another one. So we can, so rather than starting with basics and building up to advanced, every month has some basic skills going up to advanced within that month.
Right.
And then we layer it on top. And that means people can join anytime, which actually makes it financially viable. Otherwise, it probably would be difficult to maintain a course like that. Although, you know, the courses in London, when we used to run those, people only used to come in the summer. They used to be a summer school. But you'll have to wait a whole year to do it, you know.
And I think that's the beauty nowadays of online. I think, well, and I guess this is an interesting question. It feels nowadays like there are more people discovering hypnosis and embracing it and learning it nowadays. And that there are so many more hypnotherapists out there than there has been ever before. How do you feel that will impact on the industry over time? Do you think that will have terribly much of an impact at all?
Those therapists who are doing it for the right reasons, that is not for ego, not to have a sense of controlling others with power or whatever, that there's a portion of the kind of industry that attracts those kind of people. Then they offer those kind of courses and people get involved in that. Street hypnosis, I would say, is something to do with that, although I don't know much about it. I think the people who are in it for very good reasons, because they really want to make a difference to the lives of others, they will survive because their commitment is there. It's all the others that will fall by the wayside, I think. And the reason those people will succeed who want to make a difference is because they are making that commitment to their clients, which means they'll be much better. They'll be more skilled than others. So it's like anything, you know, it's like a craze at the moment, and it'll phase out longer term. But the people who are committed and actually really want to make a difference will get better results. They're the people who will survive it. But I understand what you're saying. Is there enough money in it for people to make money? Well, it's difficult for me to answer. You know, a large percentage of my students are people in the caring professions already, doctors, psychologists, social workers, et cetera. That's always been the case. So for those that want to go private, I don't know of anybody who hasn't been able to, you know, who have trained with us.
I think also because of the fact that when we're talking about people who are psychologists or medical, having those additional hypnosis skills is just such a useful benefit to be able to work in a different way with their clients as well. It's really adding more strings to their bow as opposed to jumping into a new industry altogether. Yeah.
Yes, you're absolutely right. You know, even in its very simplest form, trance is a kind of adhesive. It makes what you say stick. Think of it like that. Even without the psychotherapy, whatever you say to somebody when they're in a trance, whether it's a nurse working in a hospice with a patient in the bed, talking to the patient, and talking about pain control, the trance is the adhesive that makes her words stick. So if you just learn hypnosis for any of the caring professions, it's going to certainly enhance the quality of the work without any doubt. But you add to that therapy as well, you've got the whole package.
Exactly. But, you know, it's funny because obviously we've had an increased focus on vaccinations over the past couple of years. And I know that I went to get a vaccination recently and the nurse said to me, now you're just going to feel a sharp little sting. And I thought, why won't you learn some basic hypnosis suggestions so that instead of focusing on that sharp little sting, it could be something a little bit easier for me instead. So it would be great if the medical profession could embrace a few more of this kind of language in place.
The problem is the way that the media has portrayed hypnosis over the years. You know, it's perceived as being something you use to manipulate people with.
Mind control. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is, I get angry when I see people marketing themselves with that kind of marketing. You know, you can control how people think, you can get women into bed, all of this stuff you see on Facebook and on the internet. It makes me very, very angry because, you know, hypnosis could be used in education. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine if it was used in education to learn something and recall something?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not going to happen for a long time. If it does ever happen, it will be for a very long time.
It's interesting because I've spoken to many people who say that they get called in to do corporate presentations, for instance, and they're basically told, look, we love what you do and do what you do, but don't use the H word. Don't call it hypnosis. You know, whether it be people I know who work in sports, you know, they call it, you know, guided visualizations or something on those lines. And they're always changing it to be something that isn't hypnosis. And it's a shame that there is such a negative connotation in some cases with that. I remember in Australia a few years ago, we had a TV show called You're Back in a Room, a terrible TV show about a stage hypnotist. And the opening scenes were them saying, hypnosis is all about mind control. And never before have I lasted one sentence of a TV show before walking out of the room until that, because that opening line put me off straight away. So, yes. I always ask this, but I'm curious, if you could go back in time to, you know, that younger Stephen starting out in the world of hypnotherapy, what advice would you give to him now with the wisdom and the knowledge that you have now?
Get qualified as high as you can in terms of being a psychologist or a doctor. I studied a degree in psychology, but I opted out. And I really wish I hadn't done, even though it was as boring as hell. It was all about rats. It wasn't about people. But go through that. Sacrifice 3 or 4 years to do that, number one. Because that opens doors for you. It doesn't close doors. Number two, write. Write books. Number three, specialize in one area that other people are not specializing in. Because then you get invited to conferences. You can write articles in journals. So it's about respectability and it's about being an authority within a narrow field. And then, of course, learn skills to better market yourself. And that's not that difficult. When I first started, you know, I always used to ask my clients, do you mind if I contacted your GP to let your GP know what you're here for, whatever it was. And usually they'd say yes. So I would write a little note off to the GP saying your client, Mr. So-and-so, for this, stopping smoking. And I'd always follow it up with another note. And of course, what happens is the GPs start referring people to you. Free advertising. So, but know those tricks. There's lots of little tricks you can do. You can make money from free advertising articles. Know how to talk in public. Give talks. All of that.
And writing the articles are a good way to do it. And being able to cross-promote that way. There's heaps of ideas there. Absolutely. Mm. What about if we look then to the future for you? What is upcoming in the world for Stephen Brooks?
Well, I plan to carry on running the Ericksonian course, the online course, until I'm too stupid, too ill, or too dead.
So a while yet.
Hopefully, yes. Now, I intend to continue, and maybe beyond that. you know, because everything I'm doing is video recorded. It has been for many, many years. So I'm hoping it might go beyond that. I'm teaching a course. I did a Buddhist psychotherapy course last year. It was a 1-year course. And I've now created a course on non-attachment. Mm-hmm. So it's a Buddhist principle, but I've taken the word Buddhist out of it because I felt that a lot of people think that it's a religious course. It's not. And so it's a non-attachment course. And that's starting this year in March, although we're full already, but I'm going to be running that several times this year. And I will come back and teach in other countries as I used to before internationally, but not too much. I like to stay home now. I've got that kind of comfortable with working online.
You know what? I think if there's one thing the pandemic has shown us, technology has really come to save the day.
Absolutely.
And the number of people who were so scared of technology before the pandemic came along, if there's one blessing that's come from this, it's really pushed people outside their comfort zone with it. And now I think the opportunity to be able to speak globally is just too wonderful to turn down.
Well, you start with, you have access to a lot more clients, if you think about it, and just use any popular medium like Facebook, you know, that can go out to the world if they're interested in what you're doing. It's a huge leap for hypnotherapists. I think it's going to be really beneficial. I did make a little video a little while ago to say to people, look, you have to move online. This was about 2 years ago. You're going to need to move online, number one. Number two, there's going to be a lot of people who need your help. And number three, lower your prices. Because you can see a lot more clients I lowered my prices from £300 a session, which is what I've been like for the last 10 years, to 125. Okay, I've got too many clients. I don't want to see so many. In fact, it's taking up too much of my time. And I think that's good advice. Lower your prices because you have a wider market. It's a fantastic time.
I have to admit, even for myself in the last year or so, there's been clients from Germany, the UK. I think there was one in India. And that never would have happened for me 2 years ago. So it's truly been in some ways a blessing in allowing us to reach more people and to be able to help more people as well, which is really wonderful.
Well, yeah, I think we're all very lucky in a way, indirectly, that we have businesses that can transfer online so easily. There's a lot of people who are not in that position, like restaurants or whatever. So we have been very lucky.
If people wanted to reach out to you and to find out more about your training opportunities or to explore some of your work, how can they best do that?
Well, either type in, our website is BritishHypnosisResearch.com. Or you just type in Stephen Brooks hypnosis and it'll take you to that site plus other stuff as well. So Stephen Brooks hypnosis in Google or the URL BritishHypnosisResearch.com.
And I have to say also a massive thank you to you for the wonderful video content that you have produced both in the hypnotherapy groups that are out there on your YouTube channel. There is so much content that you have created and given so willingly and freely. You know, I think everyone should be sending you a thank you to say, you know, thank you for just constantly inspiring us and giving us some insight and wisdom.
Well, I love to do it. I mean, that's what it's about, isn't it? It's making a difference. Actually, do you know about this?
I have seen that. So this is a new book that's coming out or is currently out?
It came out last year and it got number two, the second best book in hypnotherapy for last year. It's not written by me, although I'm the subject of it. Without the beard. It's written by Jos van Boxtel. He's a Dutch psychologist. And he decided, this is volume one of three volumes, of three issues. This one's, it's all about language skills mainly. And so he's taken therapy sessions I've done and he's analyzed them all. And this one is about phobias. But the most important part is his bit. I mean, the second part is a transcript with his commentary about what I'm doing. But the first part, he breaks it all down with all the language patterns, etc. And I think the next one is, obsessive compulsive behavior. I think the third one, depression, I'm not sure. I can't remember.
Sounds like a fantastic series.
It's done very well.
When you were you working with him alongside on that, or did he simply take the transcripts? And so when you read the transcripts and his breakdown of it, what were your thoughts going through as you were looking at that?
I thought it wouldn't work. I thought he'd give up, because several people have tried to do this before, you know, even to the point where I'd fly to Belgium. I was one psychologist at university that I'd fly to Belgium, and we'd work through it together, and she just gave up. It was taking up too much time, and like she couldn't handle it all. So when Joss was one of my students originally. So he used to be a scientist, you know, he has a scientific mind, but he's also a psychotherapist. So he has the art side with, as well as the science. And he started to analyze my work and show me what he could do. And I thought, oh, wow. It's a little bit like Rossi, when Rossi worked with Erickson, you know, so Joss is kind of investigating what's happening. So I was very flattered when he asked. And actually, talking about Rossi, Rossi gave this book an amazing review. Where is it? Is it, you know, Ernest Rossi, the Ericksonian?
Ernest Rossi, yes, who sadly passed away.
He worked with Erickson all pretty long. Wow, if it's possible to condense the evolution of psychotherapy over this century and Milton H. Erickson's legacy with clarity, simplicity, and compassion. Stephen Brooks and the Art of Compassionate Ericksonian Hypnotherapy surely sets the highest standard.
My goodness, wouldn't that make your heart sing to read something from Ernest Rossi like that? That's just...
Well, I started with Ernest Rossi, you know, years ago. I was reading Rossi back in the 80s, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I got that quote from Rossi, wow. I contacted him immediately and said, you know, you don't realize how important this is for me. Yes, so good. Cream on the cake.
Stephen, I should let you go, but I want to thank you so much again for agreeing to do this podcast. I have to admit, I've been slightly intimidated and starstruck through this one today. Normally, I don't get like that when I'm in front of people, but there's something about your achievements and something about just even your presence that has given me that. So I want to just say thank you to you for the absolute thrill of being able to chat with you today. And I wish you all the absolute best.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it. You have some great questions. And thank you for inviting me. Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah.
For everyone listening, I hope you managed to grab a few nuggets there of wisdom that you can take away and use straight away. In the meantime, please stay safe, take care, and we'll see you next time.